$100 Android One phones might be coming to the U.S. soon. You can now search CIA documents all about aliens. And Twitter is having a yard sale and Google's buying. All that and a whole lot more coming up on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for Twit's audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make Twit even better. And thanks for your continued support.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1686, recorded Wednesday, January 18th, 2017.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Grasshopper. Stay connected and run your business from your mobile phone with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, visit trygrasshopper.com/twit. Welcome to Tech News Today. This is a show where we tell you everything you need to know about the tech news today.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell. It's a brilliant name, really. Not my name. Yeah. The show's name.
Sure, Jason my Howell name is a brilliant name. Your
my name
mother
is pretty
and father
amazing.
Are amazing.
No, Tech News Today, it tells you exactly what we are going to do today, which is Tech News You.
Yes, let's do it.
Yeah.
The information says the cheap Android One phones could come to the U.S. by the end of this year. The Android One platform was designed to provide cheap phones without all that bloatware, the lack of updates, and the insecurity. But the new report implies that growth of Android One will bring more uniformity to the entire Android ecosystem. Sources at the information did not know who would make the phone, but they suggested LG as a possible partner. Yeah. Now, these will be a little more expensive, between $200 and $300. The Android One in India and other places were between $100 and $200.
Yeah, they started their first generation was right around the $100 mark. I mean, Android One's mission from the get-go was really all about higher quality hardware, low cost, because it was really targeting developing markets like India, where it launched initially, and a bunch of other markets that expanded to. It was really about just being the first smartphone for a lot of people. And the only way that you could do that in a lot of these markets was to offer it for really, really low cost.
And so they're going to guarantee software updates with these when they come to the U.S. I guess that was part of the problem. They had this idea that it was going to be sort of uniform, but there were a lot of gray areas. And then a lot of those really cheap phones came with bloatware and came with, you know, you never got updates on them.
On like inexpensive phones that you get in the U.S. already or whatever. Yeah, I mean, when you go to the really low end of Android, you don't know what you're going to get. Like there is a big cost that comes with, saving that money initially, like you say, bloatware, usually very low amount of storage, so you can hardly install anything on it before it fills up entirely. Just also, you know, no updates. It might be totally outdated. Like there are phones that are being sold in KitKat, which is versions old at this point, years old. So this is just a way for Google to kind of make sure that people have a low cost option, especially when you consider that the Pixel just came out. And that is absolutely not a low-cost option. So this gives Google kind of something on the other side. I will say that I was kind of surprised to see that Android One would come to the U.S. because I just never thought that was kind of part of the playbook. It really seemed like from the beginning this was about emerging markets, and now it seems like the purpose is opening up a little bit. It's not just about let's get people who have never had a smartphone to own a smartphone by lowering the cost super low. Now it seems to be like, oh, this is just our low-cost Android arm, you know? And not that that's a bad thing. That's great. I'm very curious to see what they do. And they've worked with LG a lot in the past and done some really great things with LG. So
Google hasn't confirmed this. This is just a report in the information. But usually the information is pretty good and well-sourced. So I do think that this will happen. And I wonder where they will sell them. Because, I mean, will it be like the phones you see in the grocery store? Because you can even, I mean, that's what's crazy. Like, you have your kids being like, oh, can I get that Android phone? it used to be like that box of cereal. Now it's like, can I get that $100 Android phone? Like, here are all the reasons why I'm not going to buy you that Android phone.
Right.
Because we've heard that that some of the phones have spyware on them, right? Like, that they're tracking your information. That was
depending on the hardware and where the hardware is coming from. I mean, we've certainly heard about some like Chinese manufactured devices having something in there that they probably wouldn't call it spyware, but it was ad tracking that some would refer to as spyware, depending on how you interpret it. So I'd be curious to see where it ends up being sold to. This is supposed to happen by the middle of the year. So we won't have to wait that long to find out where we'll find it. But if it'll be like the grocery store line, but I mean, those phones that you find in the grocery store line are generally like really, really cheap.
Yeah.
Like this is still $200 to $300. Right. That's Moto G territory, in definitely lower end, but not like ridiculously, $50 and here you go. Here's a piece of plastic.
Yeah.
So, curious to see that. All right. Well, that was quick. A South Korean court reached a decision to dismiss the arrest warrant that it held for J.Y. Lee. He's the head of Samsung. He was being held on bribery charges, among a few other charges, after 22 hours of questioning that he had last week and then being held overnight last night at a detention center. Lee was set free with the judge saying an arrest at this point anyways is unnecessary. Doesn't necessarily mean that Lee is totally free and clear of the charges, just able to go home and avoid further detainment. And I'm sure Samsung is very, very pleased about that.
Yeah. So the probe isn't over. They're still looking into what he may or may not, how he may or may not been involved in this. As we said yesterday, there was a dressage horse involved in this bribery. It was all kinds of crazy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's good for them. Bloomberg said the emails that they recovered probably just stopped short of really, saying anything explicit about what he had done or not done. So, we still don't know for sure, but yeah, he's not in jail.
I mean, when it comes down to it though, like we were talking yesterday with Elise, like the power over kind of the economy within South Korea of Samsung is so massive that you have to wonder how much of that plays a role in whether they allow for this to happen or not. And I know that they're saying, no, this, what's wrong is wrong and we have to do that. But I mean, 35% of the gross domestic product in South Korea is due to Samsung. I mean, you arrest Lee, you move the economy in a major way, potentially. So I have to imagine that has some influence over this case.
Mm-hmm. The CIA has released 13 million pages of declassified documents online going back decades. If you have an internet connection, you can search the database whenever you like. Aliens, state-funded mind control, precognition, and telepathy are just some of the programs you can read about in this database, according to BuzzFeed. So this was declassified information, but it wasn't really available. You had to go to Langley, Virginia. You had to go. It was only on four different computers. So now anybody can look at it through using Crest, which is the CIA record search tool. I tried to search it, and it was not down, but it was too busy.
Yeah, well, I imagine. Yeah. But it's like, finally, I can pick through the CIA records. Mm-hmm. It's the result of a suit by a nonprofit called Muckrock. That's what it said. It could have been typo.
Like muckrakers. Like,
yeah, but yeah, maybe it was a typo. I thought that's what it said in the article. Anyways, whatever. Muck something. In 2014, they had said that these computers may be public, but obviously it's just four computers in a very specific place, largely inaccessible to the majority of people. So during the suit, one of the users of Muckrock or Muckrake or whatever it is, Michael Best, actually launched a project where he himself spent hundreds of hours going into there, printing out all of the stuff that he was finding on there. And CIA doesn't actually charge for paper, doesn't charge for toner, all this kind of stuff. So, you know, that was just one component of like trying to apply pressure to be like, look, open it up. The CIA estimated ultimately that it would take 28 years to do it. They're like, it's going to take us 28 years to pull this off. They reduced that down to 6. And then they finally gave up and said, fine, we'll put it on the internet. And that's what we have today.
That's what we have today. So go search it. The truth is out there.
Slack is rolling out a new feature that should improve how it handles communication between large teams. Message Threads brings a new flex pane to chat windows that allow for extended comments to be attached to individual topics within the thread. Those threads can then be collapsed, expanded, helps to clean up the chat window. We use Slack pretty regularly, actually, for this show. And I mean, it's just you and I, really, because we are the team that produces this show. But I could totally see, like, sometimes going back into Slack chats within a room, it can get really noisy really quick because there's just so much stuff. It's hard to kind of keep it categorized. At least in this way, it groups things together. I imagine this would be really good for really large teams, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like I enjoy using Slack with you, but I don't think we push it to its limits because it is just you and I, and we do share a cubicle. So we should add Brian and Burke to our Slack channel so we can discuss what's going to be on the Burke cam today. And
apparently nothing. Although Burke did have Project Phi up there earlier.
Kara is also part of the Slack channel as well. Mm-hmm. She is. But nobody does this very well except possibly Facebook, like the threaded messages. Like Gmail doesn't, you know, or email doesn't do it well. If you want to only discuss one issue, chat, no chat programs really do this well. Facebook does it well, like if you're commenting on something and then you can comment on a comment. Like
yeah, Facebook
sort of,
does it well.
But nobody else does. So I really think that Slack needs this because that's their biggest criticism. It's messy, it's confusing. Oh, it's just for the kids. It's just for the millennials that can handle that. But I think it's a great tool. And something like this will add to its benefit to others.
Yeah, it seems like message threading is a really, you either love it or you hate it, it seems like. People sit on one side of the fence or the other. I've always really liked message threading. I actually don't mind how Gmail tackles threading, but I guess they're kind of different worlds between how Facebook does it and how Gmail does it just because of just inherently they're very different in how they approach it. But I think this is a perfect feature for Slack and will make it a lot more useful.
I think so, too. I mean, just being able to comment on a certain part.
Yeah.
I agree with you that I think Gmail does threading just fine. But it's when we get to fast chatting that it gets really confusing. And you can't, you know, if you're chatting back and forth really quickly and, you know, I said something 3 minutes ago and, you know, I'm saying, yes, definitely, Jason, do take the next 5 months off. I can handle this by myself. When I really didn't mean, I meant to say, yes, please get me coffee.
Those are two very different things, Megan. Yes. I can't handle this flip-flopping.
Right. Exactly. So it's just like you never want to say yes to something that, you know, in a chat. And that's why I like threading.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now I know that I can take 5 months off.
No, you cannot.
I can't.
But you can bring me coffee.
Okay.
A class action lawsuit in L.A. alleges that Apple has the ability to block iPhone users from texting while they're driving, but they don't use it, thereby causing accidents and deaths on the road. The California man who brought the lawsuits would like to halt all iPhone sales until they lock out phones to prevent texting and driving. He's not seeking any additional damages aside from his legal costs. He says the company is putting profit over customer safety. So this was an interesting one. I think if they have the ability, should they? I don't know. I mean, this gets to like what's your personal choice and what's not. There was a patent that says that, you know, it's technically possible. I mean, as we've been talking about switching Android to iOS, I was saying Android Auto is an amazing app. You have to download it separately and it doesn't prevent me from texting and driving. And by the way, I don't really text and drive. What I do, I'm guilty of looking through my podcasts while I'm at a stoplight. So, and it stops you from doing that. Like you can press a couple buttons, but today I was scrolling and it just said paused for safety. And I was like, thank you, Google.
Did you know, and Burke brought this up to me yesterday and I looked into it, new California law as of January 1st, no touching phone for any reason whatsoever.
I know.
If it's mounted in a dash mount, Then you get one tap. That's all you get is a single tap. And if you do anything more than that, that's illegal.
Mm-hmm. I know.
I think there's that. So now I know that. So, I mean, even Android Auto, right? Like, thankfully, they have the OKG command because then you can do it all by your voice and hopefully navigate and get through to where you need so that you don't have to tap it. Because even tapping it more than once would be against the law. But even beyond that, because that is a great approach, how does the technology know that you are a passenger versus a driver? That's the big challenge
that
I see. What do you mean?
Like, you could do a fingerprint on your keys, a fingerprint on your phone. I mean, there's not, like, it seems like that's not too hard to figure out. I mean, they know that this is my, I mean, yeah, a fingerprint. Like, you'd have to agree to it, I think. Like, maybe there's a fingerprint sensor in your car, and then you know, I'm the driver, I'm putting my fingerprint in, I'm putting my fingerprint in my phone, I'm matching them up.
Then so, like, you get in, and you put a fingerprint, like, on your steering wheel, and that tells your phone that you are currently the driver, and your phone goes, okay, I'm not going to do that.
I mean, that's one way to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, that requires Apple to get some new hardware out there in order to make that work. But so like Google has the ability, and I'm sure Apple does too, but I know Google has a specific hardware in their phones to detect this, to understand different activities. It knows when you're driving. It knows when you're bicycling. It knows when you're walking or running. Like, it uses, you know, the accelerometer and extra technology inside to detect that. So it knows when you're driving. And if that is the case, then if driving, then deactivate certain parts of the phone. But that doesn't work if you're a passenger. So, I mean, that might be one way to tackle that. But I think that's probably one of the bigger challenges is, does this make the experience for someone who is merely a passenger? And I've been a passenger many times. And many times I'm on my phone when I'm a passenger, you know. So if it makes that challenging, that could be a big part of why Apple doesn't want to do this as well. It just makes the experience for a lot of people just not that great.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's no way it could be mandatory. I mean, I think it would be very difficult for it to be mandatory. But I think some sort of encouragement. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't it's like the seatbelt. You know, we used to have the seatbelts that would automatically, you know. And they were just trouble, but like something like that I think would be great. But I'm not saying that I think that we should all be forced. I think we should do it on our own, but I don't know. I think this would be a good question of the day.
Yes,
and the question is, should Apple be responsible for locking your phone while you're driving? Yes or no?
Burke has something that fell over to say. He says driver only sits in driver's seat. So then the phone would have, well, that is true, Burke.
But the
driver
phone
does only sit in the driver's seat.
For now.
But how does the phone know that the driver is in the driver's seat?
Because you put I think that if you had the special mount, then you could put it, you know, if the phone is mounted, then you can't use it for anything more.
Well, then drivers just wouldn't mount it.
True.
Yeah.
But that is, I'm saying it's something that needs to encourage you.
I'm not fighting that at all. I think this is one of the leading causes of accidents in this day, and possibly I think I even saw in reading this more so than drunk driving. This is not an insignificant issue. Everybody thinks that one quick tap on the phone they can get away with and nothing's going to happen, but that's why things happen. So it's obviously a big problem. And if there's a technological way to tackle it without affecting the experience for those who aren't in that scenario, then I'm all about it.
Yeah, I definitely think that it is a big problem. I was listening to Note to Self. It's a podcast that I listen to, and it was called Distracted is the New Drunk. And in addition to it saying that, you know, this is a big problem, it's harder to tackle the problem because when drunk driving was a big thing, they used to have characters like on Facts of Life or, you know, different television shows that everyone watched. Cheers. There was always like a designated driver on Cheers.
The special episode or whatever.
I think it was like Family Ties or one of those shows where like it became the storyline, like someone dies in a drunk driving accident. And that worked because we all sat down to television, you know, to watch the same shows. And so we could say like, hey, yeah, don't text and drive. But, you know, most people out there, you know, not many people watch our show, I admit, but not as many people who has watched Cheers.
So what is everyone doing? Everyone is on social media. So we should have a campaign on social media, but then people are just going to be, you know, checking out their social media campaign while they're driving. So that's not
true. I mean, everyone is on social media, which is that's part of the social media. It's not Cheers. It's not Family Ties. It's not everybody is there in their own silos.
Yeah.
So it's harder to, you know, push this message through, you know, Michael J. Fox or whoever was on Family Ties. So, so yes, but you can weigh in on whether you think Apple or Google should be responsible for preventing us from killing ourselves. You can tweet us at TNT at twit.tv, or you can find us. That's an email, not a tweet. You can tweet it to us at Tech News Today TV. Yes, no. Maybe I'll put a tweet up there that you can, a tweet poll that you can put into.
I know a quick answer. Self-driving cars.
Yeah.
That'll help.
It will help. Coming up after the break, Google isn't buying Twitter, but it is buying part of it. Matt Weinberger from Business Insider is here to tell us what part and why. But first, let's take a minute to thank Grasshopper, the sponsor of this episode. Grasshopper works just like a traditional phone system, but requires no hardware purchase or software installation. With their iOS and their Android app, callers can reach you wherever you are on your mobile phone of choice. Grasshopper allows you to keep your existing number so you can maintain your brand. So when you make a call, your client will see your Grasshopper caller ID. They will not see your personal phone number. That can be really handy in a lot of situations. All you have to do is select a toll-free or local number, record a custom greeting, and add multiple extensions for your business. Toll-free numbers are great for marketing, and they make your business sound more professional. You can set up department and employee extensions with custom call forwarding to any phone in the world. You'll also get voicemails emailed to you as audio attachments. You can send and receive SMS text messages from your business number. There's so many features. You got to check it out. Join over the 250,000 Grasshopper customers today. They're all really pleased. Go online. See how pleased people are with this service. Don't just trust me. You can try it yourself. Plans start at just $12 a month, 30-day money-back guarantee. So 30 days to change your mind. I do not think that you will change your mind. It's a great service. Turn your smartphone into a business line with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, go to trygrasshopper.com/twit. That's trygrasshopper.com/twit. Don't forget the T-W-I-T at the end so they know that we sent you, and we thank Grasshopper for their support.
Google may have decided not to buy Twitter months ago, but that doesn't mean it doesn't want at least pieces of the company, let's say. Joining us to talk about Google's Fabric acquisition is Matt Weinberger from Business Insider. How's it going, Matt?
Doing okay. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's great to get you back. It's been a while since we had you on, so I'm happy to get you on for this. First, explain a little bit about why Twitter created Fabric a few years ago and kind of why it exists, let's say.
Okay, so what Fabric is a set of tools for that help app developers build their apps, monetize their apps. It helps them know who's using their apps how. Just a set of tools for that purpose. Why Twitter made it? That's kind of a big open question. And apparently now, almost 3 years later, they couldn't answer it. And so it is over at Google.
Yeah. So, and I mean, this is really about mobile analytics. Fabric is, many would say, one of the most popular mobile analytics platforms around. Was shedding this property, do you think, a bad move in the long run for Twitter? I mean, Twitter's kind of had a tough year. It's really trying to kind of reinvent itself and prove itself, grow users, all that kind of stuff. This seems a little bit outside maybe of its core competency, but do you think in the long run this might be a bad decision for Twitter to get rid of?
Not at all. I think, as you say, that Twitter's had kind of a rough year, that they need to focus on what they're good at, which is enabling Nazis to yell at politicians or something. But the Fabric technology, really fabulous. Developers love it, but it never really fed back into usage of Twitter in the same way. Like, you look at Facebook has Facebook login, and Facebook offers several similar services as Fabric to developers. But the difference there is that, Facebook login and all that kind of feedback in. The more you use Facebook login to log into Spotify or whatever, the more you're going to use Facebook, and the more that's all tied together with your social graph, whatever. Because Twitter's more anonymous, because Twitter is less identity-based than, say, Facebook, you know, Fabric never really played into that core social network stuff. So it never really made a ton of sense why they would spend so much time and energy and effort on it in the first place.
So what's in it for Google? Is this really about the technology, or is this more of an acqui-hire where they're trying to get more mobile developers on their team?
So a couple of years ago, Google bought a company called Firebase that also does mobile analytics. And the Fabric team is going to be joining up with Firebase under Google's developer tools division. And it kind of makes a lot of sense for them because Google also has the cloud platform, which they're really pushing as a way, as a perfect place for developers to build the stuff that their apps work on. And Fabric is a tremendously attractive set of technologies. If I'm a developer, if I'm developing an app either for iPhone or for Android, I'm going to need something like Fabric or Firebase or both to really monetize my apps and to really get them out there and really build the best app that I can. So from that perspective, it feeds right into Google's cloud strengths, even if not their search strengths.
We've seen a lot over the past couple of years of Twitter's kind of, let's say Twitter was strong when it was very pro-developer and it had quite a few years where it was really focused on developers. I feel like this was kind of part of that. Shortly after Fabric comes along, it really feels like Twitter did an about-face and started to pull away from developers, away from kind of allowing developers to create, unencumbered and have complete access to the stream behind the scenes and all that kind of stuff. Is this kind of another signal that Twitter really is not focused on kind of relating to developers in that way anymore? Is this just kind of Twitter saying, yeah, we started this a while ago. This is another piece of that puzzle.
Well, it's just kind of funny because back in 2015, Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, he got up on stage at the Twitter Flight Conference. And he got up there and he said, we really apologize that that relationships between Twitter and developers have gotten so complicated. We're here. We're listening. We want to make it right. Please come up to my team here and go on Twitter and tell us what we're doing wrong, because we really want developers to love us again. Then in 2016, they didn't have the Twitter Flight Conference at all. And then in early 2017, they spun off Fabric to Google. So, I think that Twitter is not so worried about the developer relationship anymore in search of improving the core product.
Sure. And then, like I said at the beginning of this segment, there were rumors, at least towards the end of last year, that Google might be interested. Google is one of many companies that might be interested in buying Twitter. No one ultimately ended up buying Twitter, at least at this time. But Google's buying a chunk of Twitter in this regard. Does this kind of make it even more, in your opinion, does this make it even more of a case where Google is kind of avoiding, or, it's just not necessary for Google to pick up Twitter at this time? They're getting pieces of Twitter instead.
That's right. They're buying... Like, they're buying not just the Fabric tools, but I wouldn't say it's exactly an acqui-hire, but they're also getting a healthy chunk of the talent that comes from Twitter and knows what makes Twitter tick. So they're getting some real value for whatever they paid out of this beyond just the software. And then Google, as much as it would make some sense strategically, especially since Google isn't so good at social, buying Twitter at this point would just be inheriting a whole mess of problems that they probably don't even want to deal with. So this is kind of having their cake and eating it too.
Yeah.
Do you see a future where there's just like a yard sale, a Twitter yard sale, with pieces of them? I mean, we saw Vine. Is there any news that they tried to sell that before they converted it to Vine Camera? Like, do we think there's just going to be pieces for sale?
So the report was that Twitter couldn't find a buyer for Vine. Who knows how true that was, but that's the word on the street, as it were. And I think that Twitter is kind of learning this discipline around its core product, especially given that those bids last year didn't really seem to work out for the company. I think they're really trying to pare down into something leaner and meaner, rather than have all of these things that while users love them, or in the case of Fabric, that developers love them, they really got to focus on that social networking, that tweet stream versus 6-second looping videos or any of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, work on the stickiness of the platform and just kind of explaining to people why they need to be on it, other than following modern politics, which seems to be what is a big part of Twitter these days. Man, the feed has changed a lot in 12 months. Matt Weinberger, Business Insider, really appreciate you coming on and talking to us about this tool and everything that you do. Where can people follow your work online?
You can follow me at businessinsider.com, or I'm at Twitter at Gamoid, and I think it's on the bottom of your screen, which is cool.
Yes, we do that just for you.
Yes, it's handy.
Thanks again, Matt. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Have a good night.
We got some feedback from Amy Green. She wrote us an email and she said, Megan, you said you were overwhelmed with the choices on Android. I would suggest you take all the Google options until you're comfortable with the phone. Then you can change anything if you want. There's no reason you have to decide everything at once and learn the phone at the same time. Thank you, Amy. That's good advice. I am still a little overwhelmed. I was using widgets. And it is insane what you can customize down to the, do you want to abbreviate the month? Do you want
Yeah, right. Yeah,
do you want to list the weeks? It's just like, I don't care. Just decide for me. I mean, I'm, you know, I like to customize a little bit, but to customize everything is too much.
Yeah, it can get that way on Android. I will absolutely agree. And a lot of people would say that that's one of the reasons that they love it, because they can really get in there and customize every single little pixel on the screen, you know, within some apps. But I've thought that pretty often as well. Like, it would be really nice if developers would focus, like, have something be super, like, hyper customizable, but also have like a basic easy way to change, you know, a blanket, you know, number of settings at once for people who just want to get in there and casually change things a little bit, or get into the nitty-gritty and really change things beyond. Starting off with what Google gives you is probably the best approach. And then, you know, at some point you realize, man, I really wish it did this thing. That's when you kind of go a little bit deeper and go searching, and you can usually find an app to replicate it. So I think that's a strength. I'm going to put that in the column of strength for Android.
Okay.
TNT's fan of the day is Almost on Twitter. Almost is his name, who sent us this picture of his infotainment system in his car, quote, from a sweltering South Africa. And there's Tech News Today playing. We love seeing that. I wish I could look at that and identify right away which car it is based on the infotainment system. But it's not Android Auto. That's as much as I know. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup. Post on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag HowIWatchTNT, and we'll find it.
I discovered a YouTuber today who I already love. Her name is Rosanna Ponzino. She is a baker. I had not seen her until CNET did a piece about her Nerdy Nummies cookbook. She makes a motherboard cake of Twix, Kit Kats, a bunch of Jujubes.
That looks awesome.
And more. She also makes YouTube play button cupcakes, Percy Jackson lotus flower cookies, and so much more. Plus, she's just cute as a button. Look at her little motherboard apron.
How
cute.
Yeah, she's one of the top YouTubers.
Oh, like, you've seen her before?
Yes. She's made Forbes' list of top YouTubers the last couple of years. Last year, no, 2015, she made 2.5 million. 2016, she got a little bit of a raise to $6 million.
I thought I just discovered her.
Well, you did. You discovered her.
I just discovered her, yeah. She had been discovered by others, apparently. Isn't this the greatest cake?
It's a pretty impressive cake. Yeah. I'm amazed at the, obviously at her ability to pull this off, but just like the imagination that comes in to think, I could take a Kit Kat and make a component on a motherboard, and I want to eat it.
Yeah,
the cake looks delicious.
Right. Well, Burke wants it for his birthday too. So you can make
you want it for
him.
Your birthday. Okay, we'll make it for you. Okay. We'll make that work. or someone will.
He wants it from Rosanna.
Okay. Oh, I missed that important.
That's not what we do here, Burke.
Yeah. We'll see. Maybe we can get her as a guest on the show. Maybe. I don't know. And then Burke can say hi. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, midnight UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us. That's TNT@twit.tv. Leave us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. And you can find us on Twitter. We're at TechNewsTodayTV.
And we don't make motherboard cakes, but I still think you should subscribe to our show. It's twit.tv/TNT. Tell everyone you know about it and subscribe for them too. And if you want to tweet at me about what cake you want for your birthday, I'm at Megan Maroney.
I would love to try and make a motherboard cake, but I'm pretty sure it would turn out just like any Pinterest project I've ever decided. Oh, I'm totally going to do that. It looks really easy. It would be a mess. I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to our technical director, Brian, of course. Thanks to Burke for helping out in the studio. Thanks to Kevin for editing the show. And thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We'll see you all tomorrow. Bye, everybody. Woo-hoo.